presentation.
For 2 hours and then a break?
We're going to do his presentation. Then we're going to have Ken Friedman talk to us briefly. He's the GM of WFMU, the leader in web offerings on the radio offerings on the web. A brief presentation from Otis about the virtual program director software, and then an hour of discussion taking us to a lab.
Okay. How was your flight?
Good. Good. When did you come in?
Ours was. Ours was.
Okay, we'd like to get started. If everybody could sit down, we've got a busy day and we need to start on time. John? I can do this before we're ready. Okay, everybody, we've got a decision to make before we start our first section of the board. I'll wait till everybody's ready. AC? AC? Okay, welcome everybody. We're about to get started. The first thing that we have on our agenda is a decision we have to make about the inclusion of staff members in the anti-racist training. I've asked several of them. If everybody could be quiet and sit down, or if, at least if you can't sit down, Patty, LaVarne.
Did the word share up already mean anything?
No. Okay, everybody. LaVarne, Patty, could you come join us? We're about to start. Before we start this section on licensing and distribution, we have a quick decision to make regarding the inclusion of staff members, specifically the general managers, in the anti-racist training that we have scheduled to begin at 11. And since we want to be able to give them an adequate heads up, we wanted to know the decision of the board on whether or not they would be included. Would anybody like to address the point briefly before we take a vote? Greg, can you go ahead? Odie, can you put Greg on?
Yeah. I think we'd have trouble rounding most of them up since they were not told that they needed to be here. I myself have a previously arranged appointment for part of the afternoon. Last time I know it was a point of contention. And so I asked them to attend this morning from 9 to 11. I outlined to them the times they had to be here. But it would really be a question of where those people are today after 11 a.m. And I don't know what kind of attendance you would get.
Bob?
Yeah, well, last time we decided to invite not only the GMs, but also the senior staff from the national office, and several of them did attend, even though it was a last-minute decision. So I think we should repeat that at the same time. I think it's actually too bad that they weren't notified that that might be an option for them, that they might have come. But I still think that even afterwards, that if one of the staff people here would be so kind as to make the calls to them, to invite them to come. I think, you know, we might find some of them are interested, as they were last time.
If there's no further discussion, can we take the matter to a vote? All those in favor of inviting the general managers to participate in the...
And senior staff, the national office.
And like national office staff? Do we have a working definition of this, or will there be ambiguity? The operations group, is that what we're talking about? The operations group. All those in favor of including the operations group in the training, please raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. All those opposed? Okay. Greg, could you arrange with Donna to contact those that are here?
A couple of them here right now. Sure.
Yes. The operations group. That includes the national staff. Okay. Well, it's this. Are we ready on the stream? Is that a yes?
Yes.
So we're being streamed right now? Okay, welcome. This is Friday, June 2nd, 2006. This is a retreat of the Pacifica National Board. Our formal board meeting will be beginning tonight at 6:30 p.m. But during this public session of the retreat, I'm very honored to have with us a couple of guests. The first one is Dr. Lawrence Lessig, who's a professor of law at Stanford Law School and founder of the school's Center for Internet and Society. Prior to joining the faculty there, he was Berkman Professor of Law at Harvard Law School and a professor at the University of Chicago. He represented the website operator Eric Eldred in the groundbreaking case Eldred versus Ashcroft, a challenge to the 1998 Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act. He's won numerous awards, including the Free Software Foundation's Freedom Award, and was named one of Scientific American's top 50 visionaries for arguing against interpretations of copyright that could stifle innovation and discourse online. He's the author of Free Culture, The Future of Ideas, and Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace, and he chairs the Creative Commons Project and serves on the board of the Free Software Foundation, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Public Library of Science, and Public Knowledge. And he's agreed to come and speak to the Pacifica Board about issues of licensing content as more and more audio content becomes available for digital distribution through a variety of channels. Questions regarding licensing are really critical in determining how that content reaches out, reaches people, is used by people, persists, and all the rest. We have critical questions before us about what economic models we're going to use for generating revenue in that new world, what our ethics are, and the rest of it. And Dr. Lessig has agreed to come in, talk to us about various licensing approaches, and has expressed a willingness to work with the board to design licenses that are ideally suited to our situation and ethics as part of a larger effort to expand civic media. So without any further and just so you know the structure of this, I'd ask Dr. Lessig to present to us for about 40 minutes. It's a little less than that. And then also we've invited Ken Friedman, who's the general manager of WFMU, their building situated over in Jersey City. And they're sort of the pioneer in the community radio movement on making programming available through digital distribution and on the web. And if I understand correctly, that station, community radio station, generates approximately 50% of its revenues from online distribution of audio content. So Ken's going to give us a brief presentation about their experience. We also have a quick 10-minute presentation on virtual program director, an interface for aggregating our own content. And then I think we'll have about an hour for discussion of the various issues. So without any further ado, hold on a second. Are we okay on the stream, guys?
Yes.
We're fine? Okay. In that case, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Lessig. This is his presentation, and we're going to clear out so that everybody can see the screen behind us.
So thank you very much, and I'm really grateful for the opportunity to talk to you. I'm going to actually do a lot of presentations there.
Okay, great.
I'm especially grateful because this issue of what David framed to me of civic media is an issue which is extremely important to the nonprofit that I run, a nonprofit called Creative Commons. And this was an important opportunity for us to begin to think about how civic media as an idea could interact with maybe the most important aspect of civic media we have in American culture right now, which is public stations and public radio. So let me start with an idea of a definition of what I think of as civic media. So civic media, in the sense I want to talk about it, is media which is universal, meaning it ought to be everywhere, and democratic, meaning anybody can use it. So in this sense, the classic bit of civic media that we know is text or writing, which is universal in the sense that we aspire that everybody's able to do it, to write, and democratic in the sense that the technologies of writing are such that basically anybody can afford to do it. And what's interesting is that in some periods of American history, at least, everybody could even publish because of the costs of access to publishing technologies. So, for example, at the time of the founding, printing was actually extremely cheap and universal in the United States. In constant 1970 dollars, 1790, it cost about $10,000 to set up a printing press. And that's what, of course, led to the extraordinary explosion of the pamphleteer press, which was extremely important in defining what the revolution would be, and defining that the revolution would be a revolution of ideas, as people debated ideas in print, and a wide range of people had access to that opportunity to debate ideas in print. Over time, this access to media was taken away because the cost of printing went up so dramatically. So in the same dollars, by 1860, the cost of setting up a printing establishment was about $2.5 million, meaning the influence of speech like this slowly disappeared. So that's the sense in which this opportunity for people to use text in this democratic way to communicate to others who expected to be able to engage in the same kind of expression. Now, in that kind of expression, there's a kind of creative activity. And the creative activity that we recognize just on the second's reflection is that the act is building upon the work of others. So there's a freedom that we take for granted, that when we write in this traditional sense using text, we can take and use other people's work in that writing as long as we do two things. One, we quote, meaning we cite them. And second, that we don't use too much in the process of using their other work. So creative writing in my high school was something like this. You basically took the works of Ernest Hemingway or the works of Fitzgerald, and you were told to write a creative writing essay, and that was basically mixing the two together in a way that said something creative about what you had learned from these two kinds of texts. Okay. Now, what would civic media in a digital age look like? Well, here too, I think it's universal and democratic. So what would that be? Well, the fact is we're seeing that much wider range of media now qualifies as civic media. A wide range of media has been democratized by digital technologies. So video and music and graphics are now as accessible as the pencil and the typewriter were to the generation that you and I knew growing up, right? So the point is, the technology has expanded the range of media that is available for civic media, democratized in this sense. And companies like these companies are building their whole business on the idea that they will encourage people to engage in what we can think of in the sense of being an aspect of civic media, to consume and to create and share their creativity using tools of digital technology. Now, there are a lot of examples of this. You're familiar with all of them. I just want to put them all on the table so we have a common point of reference. Blogs are the most familiar in this space. Tectorati, the indexing source for blogs, this morning reports 42.2 million blogs out there in the world. Podcasts becoming an increasingly important way in which the civic media happens. Here's Apple's podcasting site, which allows you to go through literally thousands of podcasts and subscribe to the ones that you would want. These forms of expression are changing the use of digital media as it is relevant to important public activities. So most important that blogs typically deal with is the activity of reporting. Not all of them, but a significant number of them engage in an act which is similar to, different from, but similar to the acts of reporting. And increasingly, digital media becomes a tool for reporting in a wider range ideas people have about their own life and experience in the world. My favorite is 2004. This film, Tarnation, makes a debut at Cannes. BBC says that it wows Cannes. This is a film that's made for $218. This kid took video that he had shot through his whole life using an iMac given to him by his friend. He remixed it of a quality to wow Cannes and to win the 2004 Los Angeles International Film Festival. So one part of the way these digital media get used is a way of just expressing and reporting facts around the world. A very distinct part is the way in which digital media gets used to remix culture around us. I want to give you some examples, a lot of them just because they're fun, not so much relevant, but some fun. There's this explosion of something called anime music video out there. So you know what anime are? These are the Japanese cartoons. Anime music videos where kids basically take these cartoons and they re-edit them to set them to a music track. Let me give you two quick samples of this.
Another turn to cry. No, I don't want to learn the hard way. Baby, hello. Oh, no. Goodbye. But you got me like a rocket shooting straight across the sky.
Here's another one, a little more familiar. It's a kind of remixing of culture, right? And it's not just AMVs that are doing this. In the area of music, we've seen a lot of this activity. You know this album by the Beatles called The White Album, which inspired this album by Jay-Z called The Black Album, which then inspired this album by DJ Danger Mouse called The Gray Album, which literally synthesizes the tracks of The White Album and Black Album together to produce something great. And then there's an increasing effort to report by remixing. So mixing together this idea of using digital technologies to report by using this technique of remixing. And politics has been the most important example of that. I'm going to give you three quick.
Do you ever get the feeling you are living in a virtual reality dream world? Fabricated to enslave your mind?
A live all-war edition of
American Juniors.
Shake your body!
Push him up.
But there is another sound, the sound of goodwill.
Oh, sorry, ladies and gentlemen. I'm far away in a remote place, and we get these things secondhand.
A But this one's a little simpler to make.
So to answer your question, I just know how this world works. I see on the TV screens how hard it is. We're making progress. It is hard work. You know, it's hard work. It's hard work. A lot of really good people working hard, they can do the hard work. That's what distinguishes us from the enemy. And it's hard work, but it's necessary work, and that's essential. But again, I want to tell the American people, it's hard work. It is hard work. It's hard work. There was no doubt in my mind that's necessary work. I understand how hard it is. That's my job. No doubt about it. It's tough. It's hard work, which I really want to do, but I would hope I'd never have to. Nothing wrong with that. But again, I repeat to my fellow citizens, we're making progress. We're making progress there. I reject this notion. It's ludicrous. It is hard work. It's hard work. That's the plan for victory, and that is the best way. What I said was, it's hard work, and made that very clear.
And this is my very favorite.
My love, there's only you in my life, the only thing that's right.
My first love, you're every breath that I take, you're every step I make.
So they say most of the stuff on the internet is crap, and most of it is, but some of it is extraordinarily talented, right? And extraordinarily talented as people use these digital technologies to find different, more powerful ways to speak. And just think about those political messages. They are, of course, in one sense, just remixes of media, but they have in their architecture the most powerful political message that you could deliver in this culture, because as much as those of us who write and teach texts would love to believe, as much as most of us, those of us who live life writing books would love to believe, most of the world does not get its knowledge from words. Most of the world doesn't understand arguments from words. Most don't spend their time understanding different points of view by reading books. Most increasingly get their exposure to ideas through this form of media, through a wide range of media that tries to capture and compel ideas in the way it's crafted. And this is becoming an increasingly common way, especially the way our kids use expression. This is the way they speak. Pew did a study finding 57% of teenagers had produced and shared content on the internet. That's not down peer-to-peer file sharing, that number is about 99%. But this is people who are actually creating their own content and sharing their content with others using digital technology. And so it becomes increasingly important as we have a kind of parallel reality culture being developed in parallel to the kind of professional culture that's being developed, like reality TV in parallel to professional TV, reality culture, as people increasingly use this media to create and define the culture that they live in. And it increasingly becomes a kind of literacy, the capacity for kids to use these technologies to speak. The mixture of music and images, the mixture of music and graphics, the mixture of video becomes a way for them to speak. It's how they will use these tools as they increasingly discover the power of these tools to express ideas. It's a literacy for the 21st century. Now, if you think about this idea of civic media for the digital age, there's some obvious problems which we lawyers bring to the project. Right? And the core problem is that this writing for the digital age, this kind of literacy, is under the laws of copyright now presumptively illegal. The norms that we take for granted in the ordinary context of writing for text, which are clear, these norms that say you can take and quote and use and reuse without ever worrying about clearing permission first, those norms don't exist in the context of media, or at least to the extent they do exist, they're extraordinarily unclear. Complicated system of permissions around the ability to use and to reuse media, and very strong norms within the media industry against granting permission. So these AMV sites are increasingly getting notice and takedowns from lawyers telling them that their creativity is not to be allowed. DJ Danger Mouse knew that the Beatles never give permission to remix their work in any form at all. BBC, after this kid discovered he could wow Khan for $218, he then discovered it would cost $400,000 to clear the rights to the music and the background of the video that he had shot growing up. And here's my favorite example of how weird we lawyers can be. I don't care what you think about Tony Blair and George Bush, though I guess I think I have a pretty clear idea of what that might be, but still, I don't care what you think about them or the war. The one thing you can't say about this clip is what the lawyers said when they denied permission to synchronize the Lionel Richie music with those images. They said, no, you cannot have our permission because, quote, it's not funny, end quote. So the point is, we have this practice in the industry and this rule of law that requires permission, and this rule increasingly shadows the opportunity for people to use these digital technologies to produce and share speech. It produces an illegality around these activities, which limit the opportunity for it to spread, certainly limits the opportunity to commercialize a lot of this creativity, and drives a significant set of these creative acts underground. So what would a set of solutions be for this problem created by the interaction between these new forms of expression and old practices of law? Well, the obvious one would be to think about legal reform. But the reality is that's not happening anytime soon, and the reason it's not happening anytime soon is that in America, at least, we have a kind of IP McCarthyism that governs debates about intellectual property. If you question the particular ways in which intellectual property function today, you are referred to, as I've been referred to many times, as a, quote, communist. So the only view that's available in Washington about these issues is that you're either for intellectual property or against it. Any attempt to try to get people to think critically about how far it's gone or whether it's gone too far for the media is just rejected. So in my view, at least right now, there's no real opportunity for effective, meaningful legal reform in this context. And that's made urgent projects that I've been involved with that you can think of as a kind of private reform effort. And the core one that's been taking up my life in the last 4 years has been this project called Creative Commons. So the aim of Creative Commons is to find a simple way for authors to mark their content with the freedoms that they intend their content to carry. The critical idea here is that authors are taking the step to mark the content. It's not users who make that choice for the authors. So this is an effort to move us from the kind of all rights reserved world that we live in right now to a some rights reserved world. So the author reserves some rights to himself and gives others to the public at large. So you select these freedoms by going to our site and selecting a license. The license asks you to answer three simple questions. Do you want to allow commercial use of your work? Do you want to allow modifications of your work? And if you allow modifications, do you want to require that others release their work in a similarly free way? This is a kind of copyleft idea that would force the content that was made as a derivative to be released under a similar share-alike license. Once you've made that selection, you're given a license. The license comes in three separate layers. First layer is a commons deed, a human-readable expression of the freedoms associated with your content, intended to be understandable by anybody as they try to understand what they're allowed to do with content. Second, and very different, is a lawyer-readable license, right? A billion-page document written by the best lawyers that we can find to make legally enforceable the freedoms associated with the content so that organizations and individuals can rely upon those freedoms. And third, and extremely important, is a machine-readable expression of the freedoms associated with the content, so that search engines can begin to gather content on the basis of the freedoms. So last year, Yahoo and Google both opened a portal up in their web searches so that you could search the web and filter the results on Creative Commons licenses. So you can say, show me all the pictures available for non-commercial use of the Empire State Building, and you get content gathered for you, filtered according to those freedoms. Now, we launched this project originally in the United States, but the most important extension was to expand its work internationally. So we expanded it by basically taking these three layers and extending the legal code layer, so porting the licenses from one jurisdiction into another, so that the commons deed would be translated into local languages, but the licenses would be actually ported to different jurisdictions, and the digital code, or the machine-readable expression of the freedoms, is universal across all jurisdictions. Now there are more than 70 countries in the process of porting the licenses. This is a map of the free world as it exists today. The green countries have launched Creative Commons licenses. The yellow countries will launch in the next 6 months, and the red countries are yet to be liberated in this process. And as we've expanded this internationally, we've seen an explosion in the uptake of the licenses. So in the first year, we recorded about 1 million link backs to our licenses. At a year and a half, that number is at about 1.8 million, meaning 1.8 million places on the web where people are using our licenses to release their content. At 2 years, the number was at about 4 million. At 2.5 years, the number is at about 12 million. At 3 years, which was last December, the number is at about 44 million. And in June, today, is the first time we're making this data available, the number is now over about 110 million link backs to our licenses. So there's an increasing growth rate as this project extends internationally of people marking more and more content with these types of freedoms. So let's get a sense of, practical sense of how this functions. This is a guitar track, if you can hear it, written by an activist and guitarist, Colin Mutchler, titled My Life, released on an online sound resource licensed under a Creative Commons license. The sound resource was OpSound. It was downloaded by a 17-year-old violinist named Cora Beth, and she added this violin track you should hear on top. And then she renamed the song, My Life Changed, and re-released it back to the internet for other people to remix. And we found at least 7 remixes of this song, some really fantastic, some a little embarrassing. There's a Japanese remix, My Life Changed Absolutely, which we don't show very much. But the part that my colleagues find hard to understand is that here these two creators, who had never met each other, never spoke to each other, were able to recreate legally, without any lawyer standing between them. And that's the objective of the Creative Commons project, to allow people to respect the underlying intellectual property, to build a system where it's simple for them to respect the underlying intellectual property, but to encourage a kind of legal creativity without requiring the typical burdens of that legality, which is to engage lawyers in the process of facilitating that creativity. Now, many people look at this and they say, well, why would a creator ever want to make his or her work available in this way? There are 2 very different reasons I want to identify. First is, it might actually help the creator. So, for example, many of you, I'm sure, know this fantastic band called Wilco. Their album, my favorite of their albums, Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, was hated by their record label. So their record label told them they wouldn't release the album. And Wilco said, well, we're not going to change it, so why don't you just give it back to us? So Wilco was given the album and the rights back by the record label. And then they released the album on the internet for free under terms that are basically the same as our non-commercial license. That led to an extraordinary spread of this album across the internet. And the buzz around the album then inspired another record label to buy the rights back for 3 times the price the original record label paid. And then they sold the record in the traditional way through CD. And the sales of this record relative to every other Wilco record far exceeded anything Wilco had ever done before. So the point was, this was a method, a way to increase their objective, the bottom line objective here, of selling more CDs. Or in other contexts, for example, there's a South African research council called the Human Sciences Research Council. They have about 250 researchers and 12 different research programs. For most of their history, their business method was to sell books. They would produce research books and sell them. 2001, they decided to stop doing that and instead give away all of their work free on the web. But then to offer an optional print-on-demand service. So you could get everything you wanted for free, but if you wanted a printed version, you did a print-on-demand service, they would send it to you. After 3 years, they did an evaluation of the effect on sales, right? Before, everything was sold. Now, sales were an optional, and everything was given away for free. And the result was that the sales of this department went up by 300% in those 3 years, for the obvious reason that by making it accessible, more people learned about the work, and a significant number of those people, like most of us, would prefer to actually read a report in paper rather than on a computer screen. So this was a technique, making it available in this way, to actually increase the number of research reports that were used and sales of those research reports. So those are examples of why you might use it, because it would actually help the business model that you have, recognizing there are many different business models for creators. Some are like Madonna's, where they try to control and get money for every single use of the creative work. Many others are like academics, where the objective is to spread the ideas as far as you possibly can. But a second set of reasons basically have to do with the ethic of the particular kind of creator. Because for this type of creator, releasing their work in this way is just right. And this is the objective of a sister project we have called the Science Commons Project, which actually works with science because of a common ethic among scientists, an ethic that recognizes their obligation, which is not just to create knowledge, but to create universal access to knowledge. So it's not enough for a scientist to produce a great new idea and then publish it in a journal that costs universities $25,000 a year to subscribe to, recognizing that that means just a handful of American universities will get access to this as opposed to researchers around the world. This obligation or ethic of scientists is to make their work accessible in a way that people around the world, regardless of income, can get access to it. And building upon that ethic, the Science Commons movement helps more and more researchers and academics make their work available in a way that guarantees this type of access. So MIT has put all of their online course material available under Creative Commons license to guarantee people around the world the opportunity to extend it. Rice has a project that makes course teaching material available in this way. And the most important new journal, set of journals, Public Library of Science, makes all of their journal articles available free on the web under a Creative Commons license while printing traditional journals that people buy in the old-fashioned way. Now, in each of these cases, the objective of the license is both to enable this access and also to remind scientists of the values that define their activity. Those values are values of guaranteeing access as much as discovering knowledge. Now, as we've launched this project, we've built tools that have helped build community around this creativity. I'll give you one story of this community. A couple of years ago, Wired magazine released this Wired CD, which was a CD that had tracks by these artists, so the Beastie Boys, David Byrne, Gilberto Gil, La Tigra, Danger Mouse, a whole bunch of people who released their tracks under a license that allowed people to sample or remix the work. Didn't allow them to distribute the work, the underlying work. That song was the artist, but encouraged people to build on these tracks. We then create this site called Mixtr. And what Mixtr does is enable people to see how their creative work has been remixed by others. So here's one of the songs by the Beastie Boys, which you can see is an ability to rate the song. And then you can see who's used the song. So samples are used in. And then here's an example of somebody who has remixed the song. And this song, Board on Your Backside, has been used samples these other songs listed below it. And you can see where this has actually been sampled by other artists. So the point is, by this technology, you can begin to see the community that's developing around people remixing other people's works, right? So this enables the recognition of a certain kind of artist. You can see my work is more remixed than everybody else within this community. And this project of Mixter is being rolled out into a lot of different creative cultures. So we run contests about this regular, using new music regularly. So Linkin Park was the latest of the context that we ran with Warner Records to make this work accessible in a way that people could remix it. But increasingly we're thinking about deploying in the context of schools. So imagine an LA school and a New York school that were within a community. And at the beginning of the term, each laid down tracks and invited other people to remix it. And then over the course of the term, kids from each of these schools would be remixing the music of the other, and by the end of a term or end of a year, you could begin to see the kind of creative collaborative work that had happened. And each kid would be participating and also seeing as his or her work was being used and extended by others. That's the objective of this particular site. And it's also had the effect of creating successful artists. This is my favorite example of this. This guy named Minus Kelvin, as you might guess, is a high school physics teacher. He had a very distinctive form of composition, and you can see what he's looking for here was a record label. So he launched his membership in February of 2005. In June, he was signed by a record label who discovered him in CC Mixter and has discovered a bunch of album artists in CC Mixter who they've now signed, because this is a context within which these artists can demonstrate their talent and make that talent accessible to a wide range of people. Now, the consequence, in my view, of what this activity, Creative Commons, is doing is to feed civic media. Because as a wide range of this content is accessible, then what it does is encourage people to use and reuse this content consistent with what the underlying artist had originally chosen. And that's the insight that really excited me about being able to come here and talk to you about how this idea might relate to the work of Pacifica. I take it as given here that Pacifica supports the idea of civic media. This is your history, and this is, I take it, the objective you're focusing on now. The challenge is to do it consistent with the values of public radio and also the business model of public radio, which is obviously a business model that depends upon public support for continued existence. So the test of public support is a test of your success in connecting to the civic values of the communities you operate in. So here's one idea to build upon this infrastructure that I've described in a way that might help Pacifica achieve this objective. And the idea is basically to think about content that is licensed in two ways simultaneously, dual licensed content. So imagine content licensed under a non-commercial license, meaning people were free to use that license, that content in non-commercial ways without worrying about clearing any rights because those rights have already been cleared by the license. But then there's a backup commercial license that limits or defines exactly how the work can be used commercially. And that commercial license is specified by Pacifica. So I showed you before our commons deed, which specifies the rights associated with, the freedoms associated with this particular content. Imagine this modified in a slight way. So the commons deed specifies the freedoms associated with the content, but then at the bottom you have the opportunity to click through to learn about commercial licensing opportunities you have with this content. And when you click there, you don't go to a Creative Commons site, but you go to something associated with Pacifica Radio, right? So you would specify the commercial terms that are linked to this CC content. So creating, in this sense, pod-friendly content or civic content, and all of that content would require giving attribution back to Pacifica. So one term in every one of our licenses is that attribution to the source is required. But by requiring attribution back to Pacifica, you increasingly build the recognition around the service and resource that Pacifica is making available into this community of new creators. Now, why would you want to do this? I think the answer is obvious to this, but my view is it's to identify civic media, to identify this as an ideal within democracy, that we encourage this activity of people creating and sharing ideas and culture and critique. Right? So you identify civic media and you support it. And you support it in a way consistent with at least my view of what public radio's role has been here, to support it relative to the other form of culture that gets put out there before us, commercial culture or commercial radio in this particular way. And by setting up a distinct kind of creativity and activity, civic media, my view is you build a kind of loyalty in this growing community of creators who depend upon the opportunity to engage in this creativity and would really appreciate the opportunity to engage in this creativity without fearing the legal consequences of crossing an extraordinarily complicated set of rules that copyright law is. And then there's one final reason I want to push this idea here. So, you know, we're in the middle of a war, actually many wars. I want to talk about the copyright wars. Copyright wars, which my friend Jack Valenti, the former head of the Motion Picture Association of America, calls his own, quote, terrorist war, where apparently the terrorists in this war are our children. Right? Now, this mentality, this war rhetoric, leads to the discussion of new weapons we can develop, both law and technology, designed to eliminate piracy. And that's the mentality that DC has about this issue of cultural creativity. Now, all of that war rhetoric exists oblivious to the consequence it increasingly has for our kids. That consequence is to produce a kind of extremism in our kids when our kids think about this set of regulation called copyright and a whole bunch of other regulations. I want to give you one particular example of how that extremism gets manifested by this brace of commercials.
Hi, I'm one of the kids who was prosecuted for downloading music free off of the internet. And I'm here to announce in front of everyone, we're still going to download music free off of the internet.
I fought the law and the law won. I fought the law and the law won. I fought the law and the law won. I fought the law and the...
And there's not a thing anyone can do about it.
So you can imagine how the ad execs at Pepsi and Apple were so proud of themselves that they captured the spirit of the times, which is that kids want to be able to download music free while drinking Pepsis, right? And you could actually worry a little bit about the health consequences there. I mean, they had to drink a lot of Pepsi to get free music. And but the point is, within a week, that ad inspired this counter ad that was out on the internet. So the point is that this one kind of extremism produces this other kind of extremism. And in my view, both of these extremes are wrong. Both of these extremisms are harmful. But this excess of control that's being driven by this political rhetoric around the, quote, wars we wage drives this extremism on both sides. And it increasingly drives a kind of alienation and erosion of values that are important in our kids. So my former colleague, Charlie Nesson, who teaches ethics at Harvard, describes the extremely difficult task of standing before his students and trying to explain to his students the ideas of legal ethics. So we have to explain to his students the ideas that when, for example, you come across evidence that you're under an obligation to reveal to the other side, you must turn it over to enable the process to function. And the kid's response to this is, Why would I ever do that? Right? Because these kids are raised in a context where, in a wide range of cases, all they do is disobey the law. That's what they do. That's how they live. Like, the law tells them one thing, they ignore it because they think it's ridiculous. And increasingly in the context especially of culture. Right? They'll have relations that most of our kids think are just ridiculous. And so as they live their life constantly against the law, the very idea of the rule of law is eroded. Right? And this idea that in the context of a democracy, rather than fixing the law to reflect what people actually think, we instead raise a generation of kids to internalize the idea that the law is to be ignored. That is, in my view, the most significant cost from this, quote, war. Much more important than the profits of any particular industry. It is about the very basis of what a democracy is. And this is why it's urgent, in my view, that we find a way to resist this extremism, to begin to set a space for people to be creative, where they can internalize the idea that they are creative consistent with rules about how they're supposed to behave, a kind of sanity in this space. And that, in the end, is what I view the most important contribution that civic media can make. It is a space of creative critique that embraces not the idea of violating the law, but instead embraces the idea of building upon creativity of other consistent with the law for whatever end they seek. Right? This is the kind of balance that we have to create. In my view, as Pacifica has an extremely important role to play here. You can be a leader in setting this distinct form of expression and identify it as distinct. And I'm eager to do whatever I can to help bring about that and answer whatever questions you have. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. I know everybody has a lot of questions. What I would like to do first is have Ken Friedman also present his experiences at his radio station for maybe 10 or 15 minutes, because I think this bring what Ken's going to talk about immediately brings how some of this stuff can relate to community radio and our context into focus. And then I'd like to have a discussion that includes both Ken and Dr. Lessig. And at that point, you know, it's all open. Toward the end, I'd like to take a 10-minute break and present a virtual program director, which is something Otis McClay has been working on, which is an interface for letting listener sponsors use content that we're already making available, that we've already decided we're making available on our websites for download, and it just makes it easier and more attractive for them to use that content to aggregate it in ways that other listeners will find attractive and to drive more listeners who are using digital devices for listening to use Pacifica content that we've already agreed we're making available. So Ken Friedman is the general manager of WFMU. They're based in Jersey City, and he's widely recognized as the leader and innovator in the area of making community radio available on the web, and also as the IT guru of the grassroots community radio movement. And I asked him to come and talk a little bit about his experiences of how his audience responds to that kind of media and what they're doing and lessons learned. So, Ken, it's your show.
Hey, thanks for inviting me, and thanks, Professor Lessig, for a great presentation. I'll talk about how a lot of the ideas that Professor Lessig just described have actually been implemented at WFMU, which has overall been a big success.
We need you a little louder, a little closer to the mic, and okay. A little more silence in your vicinity.
First, some background on WFMU. We're an independent community freeform radio station. We've been on the air since 1958. The station's freeform tradition actually was inspired by WBAI in the late 60s by the programming of Bob Fass, Larry Josephson, and Steve Post. And in 1967-68, WFMU became a freeform station full-time, although mostly music-based as opposed to talk and public affairs-based. Throughout the 80s, the college that owned us started going down the tubes. We became independent of the college when they went bankrupt in 1994, and we've been an independent, not-for-profit group since 1994. We own our own licenses. We own all our own facilities. We started putting song files on the internet in 1993, and as soon as I read in Wired magazine in the early 90s that it was going to be possible to distribute audio on the internet, I decided that I wanted to be there as soon as we possibly could. The biggest frustration we've had at FMU is that although we're licensed to cover New York City and a big chunk of Brooklyn, our transmitter is actually 12 miles deep into Jersey. And due to the buildings in Manhattan and so on and so forth, and just the congested nature of FM in this part of the country, we do not have full coverage of New York City. So it's been very frustrating that we don't have coverage in the area that theoretically we are licensed to coverage. We started streaming on the internet in late 1996. And initially, I think our staff saw it as a toy, and it didn't cost us anything, so I didn't get much resistance to the idea of streaming the station online. Although I started getting a lot of comments from my staff that this is nothing more than a toy, this is nothing more than glorified CB radio, as it started becoming clear that people were listening to it, other people started saying this is not radio at all, it's not radio if you're tethered to your computer, and so on and so forth. But after several months of streaming, my producers and DJs started getting emails from listeners elsewhere around the country, even elsewhere around the world, and that kind of turned the tide. People started getting very excited by the notion of people listening to them in Tasmania or Europe or Japan. And over time, we started realizing that not only were we capturing new listeners, but we were also recapturing old listeners who had moved out of our broadcast range and maybe now lived on the other side of the country, or they just moved 100 miles away and they could listen to the station again. Several years later, we decided to start archiving our programming, and I faced the same kind of arguments internally at WFMU over whether this was a good idea to present our programming on demand. Some of the arguments that went around is that we're competing with ourselves if we do that. Why would people listen to our live programming if they can listen to any other program from the prior 2 weeks? Is that a good idea? Do we want to be drawing people away from our live programming and giving them opportunities to listen to other programming that's not live? Do we want to give listeners the opportunity to turn off the programs that they don't like so they can only listen to the programs that they do like? And in fact, this was a much more lively argument, but we decided to go ahead and give it a try anyway. And what we found was that some of these things that people were worried about did indeed happen. But despite that, we were overall getting more traffic on our live stream, not less traffic on our live stream. The existence of archived programming was pulling more people in, and although it was now possible for listeners to time shift and decide which programs they liked and which programs they didn't like and base their listening on that, overall, everybody was having more listeners. And we also found that a lot of people were listening to programs that they liked that they just weren't able to listen to live. They were listening to programs on their own time frame, and that these people, just like the new streaming listeners, were acting just like our regular traditional FM listeners. They might listen to a program that airs on Monday, on Wednesday, but they were listening to it every single Wednesday. If the archive didn't show up on Wednesday, they acted like the program wasn't on the air. And overall, archiving was a huge success for us. And I should mention at this point that as things stand now, FMU has half of its listeners online. Half of our contributions come in online. We fundraise 14 days a year. And our last fundraiser, which was just this past March, we raised $880,000.
Can you repeat that? How many days?
14 days a year. $880,000. $880,000. And half of that, over half of that, came in online, came in via our website. And we found that a lot of listeners prefer to pledge online. Bear in mind that just because people pledge online doesn't necessarily mean they're listening online. They can listen to FM and pledge online. They can listen online, and they can call a telephone to pledge. So one does not equate the other. And we've also found, interestingly, that the majority of our online audience is actually from within our FM signal. While we do have listeners elsewhere around the country and elsewhere around the world, and that's very, very exciting for my staff, and it's a big morale booster for my staff to get emails from people around the country and around the world. The vast majority of our online listening happens from inside our traditional FM coverage area. It's just that people might listen to the FM signal in their car or at home, but when they're at work, tethered to their desk at their computer, they're going to listen online. So the most common type of listener we have are people who are listening both online and to FM, depending on where they are. In the last couple of years, we've gotten more involved in podcasting and blogging, and adding secondary and even a third possible stream. And again, I'm finding the same arguments and concerns among my staff. The biggest concern about podcasting was that this would allow listeners to listen to WFMU in a vacuum. They don't have to experience the station's community overall. They don't have to listen to our live programming at all. They can just go to iTunes, subscribe to a podcast, and listen only to that program and nothing else. And what kind of loyalty would that build up to the radio station? And again, in a certain small segment, that is true. But overall, we've recaptured a lot of old listeners. We've captured a lot of younger listeners who only experience audio and radio-type programming via podcasting. A lot of teenagers and people in their 20s and even their 30s just aren't listening to the radio anymore. And we brought a lot of those people back into our fold via podcasting. And overall, the approach that we're taking with our online strategy is a charitable business model. It's the same business model that we had prior to the internet, which is that we put out our programming for free. 90% of the people who listen to it are going to be freeloaders, and they're never going to contribute to the radio station. But the more listeners we have, the more non-freeloaders or donors we will have. And we've applied the same notion to the internet, and it's worked and paid off extremely well. So while we've toyed around with the idea from time to time of having a subscription model, we've rejected that because that doesn't really work in a big way out there in the real world on the internet. There's so much stuff available for free that if we charge people for it, if we restrict access to it, if we try to make online listeners play by the rules that we want to make them play by, then we're just going to have fewer listeners. And the idea that we're trying to pursue is that we want as many listeners as we can possibly get, and a certain percentage of them will pony up when we ask them for money. And that idea has worked very well. In the last year, we've worked hard on our blog, and again, I'm finding the same arguments by some people on my staff that the blog is too much competition to ourselves. Why should we put up a blog where people can download Creative Commons movies, music that we're getting permissions from bands or labels for? Why should we put these song files and movies up? Because people can't listen to WFMU while they're watching an online movie. They would have to literally turn off our stream in order to download and watch a movie that we're making available. My view of that is that if we don't compete with ourselves, other people will do it for us. And by competing with ourselves, we are at least keeping people, our listeners, inside the WFMU fold and inside our own community. And if we don't pursue these things that compete with ourselves, then we will lose part of our audience altogether. I don't see the competition that we face at WFMU as much from other radio stations as anywhere near as much as just from other online entities such as blogs. Lately, especially a site like YouTube, I see as our biggest competitor out there. I just based that anecdotally on the number of our devoted listeners who tell me that I spent all night last night downloading music videos on YouTube or watching videos on YouTube. One aspect of this I haven't mentioned is the waivers and the licenses that we've pursued, which Professor Lessig went into great detail. We developed the same notion ourselves where we get record labels and bands to sign off on a one-page waiver. We don't have as many of the variations as they do at the Creative Commons site, which is really important to do that. And I think we're going to have to start doing that exact thing, because while Professor Lessig showed many different versions of the license, we only have one license, which is probably the most, more like the lawyer-readable version that you saw up on the screen. And it's important for us to have more human-readable versions of our waiver. But we have gotten hundreds and hundreds of waivers from independent record labels and artists telling us that it's okay to do various things with their music, including violating the DMCA provisions that would limit us from doing a special based on their music, or from pre-publishing the existence of their music on our streamer archive, or archiving their music for longer than what's legally allowed, or making song files available, and so on and so forth. So we've put a lot of effort into that, but unfortunately nowhere near enough. I'm finding that as far as we've gone at WFMU in this area, and we are looked within the world of community radio as a leader in this area, I feel that we're not moving anywhere near fast enough. I feel that I'm underfunded to be able to get there as quickly, and that we're not quite ready for the challenges that are coming down the pike. One of the biggest challenges I see coming down the pike now is the Perform Act, which would essentially make MP3 streams illegal and replace MP3 as a format with a digital rights management protected version of a streaming format, which I'm very concerned about because my MP3 streams, of all the formats that I stream in, those are by far the most popular streams. And if I suddenly announce to my audience that our MP3 stream will no longer be available as of January 1st, and if you want to listen to WFMU online after that, you're going to have to put a new sound card in your computer, I will lose most of my online audience. They simply will not do that. As much as they may love FMU, if they have to buy a new sound card, put it in their computer, that's just too great of a hurdle for most people to go through. They will simply listen to other things, they will watch other things on the internet, and I will lose them as listeners and lose them as contributors. So I see that as a huge threat looming to our online strategy. And the way I would try to get around that threat, I'm sure, is going to raise more arguments than I've ever seen internally at FMU, because I think the best solution around that problem would be to create a third stream of programming, which would be a completely pod-safe stream of programming. That's going to mean really stepping up my efforts at creating a Creative Commons type or pod-safe database of music and programming and talk that we can draw from. It's going to mean creating a third stream, which people will see as direct competition to ourselves. Again, why would people listen to WFMU proper if they can listen to the PodSafe version, the PodSafe stream that we're going to put up? And I have to admit that some people will do that. But the point is that I feel that if the Perform Act does become law and I don't do that, I will lose those people altogether. So it's better to compete with ourselves than to lose those listeners altogether and keep them out of the fold. The one aspect of this that I haven't gone into, which is to what degree are we freely giving away our programming to other radio stations? And that's an area that hasn't been resolved at FMU yet. While we freely give away our programming and our podcasts to listeners, we have not yet determined what our policy is going to be to other radio stations, whether they're online or FM, that want to use our programming. We have given limited permission to people to reuse our programming on other radio stations, especially online radio stations. But we have not given wholesale permission. From time to time, we get requests from other online radio stations whether it would be okay to subscribe to all 15 of our podcasts and rebroadcast all 15 of our podcasts elsewhere. We have not given permission to other online radio stations to do that because it doesn't fit into our charitable business model, which is that we want as many listeners listening to us, to all of our offerings, coming to our website as much as possible, keeping people in the WFMU family, keeping them in the community so that when it comes time to try to pay our bills for the year, they'll be there for us. And the idea of allowing other broadcasters to just freely use any of our programming without any restrictions doesn't really fit into that. So we're in a atmosphere where there's been an incredible democratization of media out there, and a lot of people in community radio constantly go back and forth between seeing online broadcasting and all the various possibilities for radio stations online as either a threat or an opportunity. And unfortunately, it seems to usually be one or the other. People either see these things as a threat or as an opportunity. They're both. They're both a threat and an opportunity. It depends what we do with it. And I think that it's important for community radio to not look at the internet as a toy or something that can be used just to raise money or just to maybe distribute one programming, but to look at the internet as another means of transmission that's every bit as important as your FM transmitter and your tower and your antenna that sits on top of your tower. and incorporate it into your overall existence. And that's pretty much what I have to talk about. And
so thank you very much. I'm going to open it up for questions. I just want to emphasize before we start, Brian has made this point, Lonnie has made this point, that Pacifica doesn't have a coherent licensing policy for its content. Everything's right now ad hoc. And this is not an... That's not for all our content. It may be for the archives, but in terms of the use agreements for somebody who comes in, we don't have a coherent policy for all our content. It may be for the archives.
We just don't use it.
Pardon me?
It's been there. We just don't use it.
Okay. Well, then I stand corrected if I misspoke. The idea of this conversation is that we need to deal with even if we do have it, we haven't had a discussion about how it relates to our various ethics at the board level. And so this is an opening effort to do that. And to repeat, Dr. Lessig has offered to work with us to design licenses that do the things that we want to see. I imagine we're going to have different points of view on that, but let's get them out and talk about them. So I saw Rip with his hand up first, and then I'll just go around this. I'll just come around the loop this way. Go ahead, Rip. Wait, one other thing. We have about 40 minutes left, of which we have about 10 minutes for another presentation, but if we could delay, since we have an hour and a half of break during the day, if we can delay a few minutes the start of the training, maybe we can take that back by having shorter lunch period if people want to do this a little longer. It's up to us when we get there, but we're scheduled to end at 11. Go ahead.
Good morning, Ken. I've got a couple questions about how it worked at your station. The first one is, how much staff time has the station needed to use to develop this? And also, do you have the tags on the podcast for FMU?
Do we put ID3 tags into our podcast?
Yeah, or something at the beginning when they first start listening to the podcast. Do you have your own message on there?
We don't have an introductory fundraising message. We don't put that in front of our streams, in front of our archives, or in front of our podcasts. Again, we want to just have as few hurdles as possible to people listening to us online. So we don't ask people at the beginning of the stream, you know, to please contribute. Because again, it's just an annoyance, and I feel like it's just going to cut down the number of online listeners we have. So no, we don't put any kind of fundraising message at the beginning, middle, or end of any of our online offerings.
Staff time?
Staff time has pretty much been about 1.5 positions. I have a full-time IT person at FMU, in terms of paid positions anyway. I have one full-time IT person who deals mostly with hardware issues, and I'm probably spending about half my time on various online activities these days. And then in addition to that, there's a volunteer IT staff of about a dozen people. But in terms of full-time paid staff, it's about 1.5 positions.
Bob? Alan.
Sorry. I should add that it's nowhere near enough. That 1.5 full-time positions doesn't come close to what we need to be doing right now. I could easily use two more full-time people with what we're doing, especially if we're going to try to set up a full-time PodSafe stream.
And then, so economically, does that work out? You're making enough money to pay for those two positions out of that?
Yeah, the station operates with more or less a balanced budget.
I have a number of questions for you, but first a very basic question for you. The presentation that you just gave, is it available on the Internet?
I made it available. I mean, I made it for you, but right. I'm happy to give it to you, of course.
Oh,
I have
yeah.
A Creative Commons license.
Yeah, no, that'd be great. And I'd love that, actually.
Sure.
And also... is there a website that you'd recommend for us to go to continue to?
So everything about Creative Commons is at creativecommons.org.
You had another question. Go ahead.
I had a bunch of questions for. Is Ken Freeman correct?
Yeah.
Freeman. Your format of your radio station, music, politics, volunteer programmers, staff paid programmers, and I'll have a follow-up to question to this.
It's almost all volunteers, 24 hours a day, and it's mostly music. We intentionally do not have news programming just because it's expensive and difficult to produce, and most of our audience is in the New York area that has, at last count, 7 or 8 full-time radio news stations.
The average hour length of a show, how many hours?
3 hours.
And then you put up all 3 hours consecutively.
Yeah, we record every show. We have 3 different computers at the station that record every single show, 24 hours a day.
I think that I work on one music show. I'm generally in, and the music show is also available on a website that the people who do the music show, it's an incredibly popular show. But I understand why people go then for weeks and months back to this website and download the show because it's a music show. I don't know if you've thought about this, but any reflections on how this model might work for political talk radio? After all, it turns over more quickly, the relevance and irrelevance.
Well, you actually have a lot more freedom if you're talking about talk programming, because as soon as you have music programming in there, you have the, you know, you have the right issue, all the rights issues related to all the music that you're programming. So we don't make our archives available for download. The only programming that we make available for download are our 15 podcasts, which are mostly talk programs, but some of them are music programs where we have the rights to the music as well. So you have a lot more freedom with talk programming than you do with music programming.
And one final question, because this is an issue at our station that is being resolved, I think, constructively. But what about your programmers? Do any of your programmers have unique websites related to their shows? And have they wanted to have those? And how do those conflict with the station making their shows accessible?
We encourage our DJs to set up their own websites and their own blogs. And, yeah, a few of our programmers have done that. One of our programmers has set up his own website that's very extensive with all sorts of offerings.
Including the shows?
Yeah. We don't let our programmers set up pages with their archives. We want the archives and the streams. I mean, we let them put up links to the streams, and we encourage people to put up links to their streams. But in terms of the archives, we want that all the archive streaming to come back to our site. We do have certain rules about what they're allowed to put on any WFMU.org page. So DJs are not allowed to sell any of their products on any page that's on the WFMU.org domain. If people have items related to their show that they're trying to sell, they have to put it on their own website.
And lastly, again, I'm sorry, this is coming to fruition at KPFK. This is an issue we're resolving. It's ongoing. Do you then ask the programmers on their website when they link to your site for the download that maybe it explicitly says it's coming from WFMU? Do you ask that that be made clear on those websites?
No. And during fundraising time also, we put up a little banner ad that allows people to initiate a donation to WFMU from any other site. And we email the code for that banner out as many places as we can, and we encourage people to put it on any blog that they can get it on, any other website that they get it on. And for the most part, pledges are initiated on our own website. And the only other websites that we get any significant number of pledges initiated on are our DJ's own websites.
And if I may then, for the group, just to say, we have about 5 to 7 programmers who are way ahead of the station on this curve.
Don.
Well, thank you for both of these presentations. It really, I'm not exactly a techie, so this really raised my consciousness and understanding. I just wanted to briefly ask about attribution and how you can enforce attribution. And so, Ken, for instance, is this too far out that you were talking about other radio programs, other radio stations actually using your programming? Can you enforce an attribution like the following program is made possible through the courtesy of, and then forcing others to give the exact location and how their listeners can actually come to you? That is to say, how strongly can you enforce, even with other radio stations and with all using, enforce the promotion of WFMU and like KPFK through an imposed legally binding attribution to the source?
That's probably
in the context of Creative Commons licenses, every license has an explicit attribution requirement. And you get to specify what the attribution is. So you can say attribution is to be given in the following way. And so you could specify precisely that attribution to say this comes from KPFA, broadcast on blah, blah, blah. Now, in what way is it enforced? Well, technically, when someone is downloading content from a website, they're making a copy of it. Copyright law, because of its expansive, endless reach, means that every time they make a copy, they've got to have some kind of permission to make the copy. The license is the permission. The license says, here's what you've got to do in order to avoid being a copyright infringer. You've got to give attribution, or you've got to not use this for commercial work, or whatever the license says. If you don't obey the license, then you technically have infringed the copyright, unless you can claim fair use, which is a very vague and uncertain category. So in that sense, it's enforced. It's not enforced in a technical sense. Like, there's nothing we're building into the code to force people to see any attribution. But a very important principle that Creative Commons is built on is that we want to make rights visible, or we want to express rights. We don't want to use technology to enforce them, because when you use technology to enforce them, you break the opportunity for lots of people to use the material in ways that nobody ever expected. So that's the sense in which we would enforce them.
I saw Rob, then Ambrose.
I just wanted to ask Ken if you could talk a little bit about how you quantify your audience now that you're in the digital distribution, and if you could talk a little bit about the increases in audience and financial support that you've seen over time.
Well, in online radio, it's very easy to see exactly how many people are listening, and it's very easy to generate reports, so you see exactly what's going on, much easier than it's not possible at all in FM. In FM, you're dealing on a survey-based model, which is just a sampling of a very, very small number of people, and you're extrapolating it to the general population. But with online radio, you can see exactly how many archives are getting streamed, exactly how many logons you have on a stream. It's a little bit different between live streams and archived streams than it is with podcasts, though, because with a live stream and with an archive, you can pretty safely make a presumption that if that stream or archive is running, there's probably somebody listening to it. It's true that somebody may have just turned it on and then walked away or left for the weekend or whatever. But for the most part, you can make a presumption that a stream and an archive that's streaming along has a listener. Not so with podcasts, though. I have no idea what's going on with podcasts. I can see how many podcasts get downloaded, but I have no idea how many of them actually get listened to. I suspect that a great deal of our podcasts get downloaded and never get listened to. Some people have talked about building software into podcasts such that it reports back to home base when the file actually gets opened, but that only works on a computer. That wouldn't work on an iPod, for example. So it's a little harder to know of these, you know, if I have a show that has 5,000 downloads per month, how many of those equate to actual listens? That's a big mystery to me.
Ambrose.
I'd just like to ask the professor, how does one use this creativity that's used in music, in public affairs, to help us expand our listenership? How best can we do that? Because a lot of us have a great deal of public affairs programs running from our national Democracy Now to local early morning shows and an hour public affairs shows of all kinds. How do we use what you're suggesting for those kinds of programming?
Well, I'm not sure that every kind of programming could actually use it. But I am sure that what the objective of a station in general should be to increase the amount of civic media in this sense that you can use. And in my view, the way to do that is to begin to recognize the creator and the community that's built around the creativity. So again, that site that I showed you, CC Mixter, which is about surfacing creative work and also surfacing the community that has contributed to that creative work. builds a sense among the community, members of the community, about why this is a project they ought to be devoting their time to. I'm sure you've all seen the Wikipedia project, which is this extraordinary online encyclopedia that's been built totally voluntarily by people around the world, tens of thousands of people making contributions. It has a staff of exactly one full-time person. And it is, I think, now the fifth most frequently visited website in the world. What's very important there is that people recognize that it's a community contributing, and the licensing explicitly says you're contributing to a community, and that work gets to be used by others. And it's inviting people. Again, my band Wilco, as Jeff Tweedy says, it's inviting the audience up on stage. That's the idea. Invite them on stage, right? So, one way to do this in the context of music, again, this is not a public affairs idea as much, but in music is to run these remix contests, right? So we can give you the software for free, and you run the remix contest, and over a course of 4 months, you know, you slowly show the stuff that has been contributed that's better and better, and each week it's something better and better until you have the winner. It's something that drives attention towards that type of creativity. In the context of public affairs, though, this is a point that I thought came out of what Ken was saying was very interesting. I've been struck, as we see digital media develop, with the dearth of real useful archives to get access to our public affairs past. So, for example, think about the recent, you know, dispute raised about whether the president knew that the levees were going to give way, right? He so came on national television and said, "I didn't know the levees were going to give way," and then there was released a video where there he was being told the levees are going to give way before he said that. Okay, so some people might think he was not telling the truth.
How about that?
Yeah. Okay, so, you know, remember...
Is that possible?
Yeah, so, but remember, just a couple years ago, we impeached a president for not telling the truth.
Yes,
right?
We did.
Now, imagine if accessible to everybody were all the news programs around the time when we were impeaching the president, with all of these sort of self-righteous members of Congress getting up and saying, it's the president should never lie to the American, you know, and just clip all those things together and pull them together and then match them to the stuff that was happening around Katrina, right? The point is, we have the technology to do it. We have the will. People would love to be able to do it. We just don't have the resources. They don't exist out there. All of these television resources are kept by Vanderbilt in a way that's not accessible for this type of use. And what's necessary is that people begin to supplement the archive resources out there to make it so people can build these kinds of shows. And that's one way, I think, that, you know, public affairs programs can do it. You have an extraordinary archive of attitudes at particular times in the history, you know, just of the last 10 years. Imagine being able to selectively pull them out and tell stories, wrapping them together. And imagine inviting your audience to do it. And when you invite your audience to do it, then the great ones you show. Right, Al Gore's new television station, Current TV, gets 30% of their programming from their audience. They invite their audience to submit programs, and what they use, they pay for. But they get 30% of their programming from their audience. And they're now, it's extraordinary explosion around the world. They have some 40 million households that they're going to right now. But that's a model, right, for your stuff, too. You tell us news stories. You begin to give it to them, and then stuff that you like, you use, and the other stuff you maybe just make available.
I want to add one other thing. When Sound Posse makes its stuff available, we do one-hour talks typically. There's a guy in New York named Andre who takes our stuff and that of others and puts it behind music. He's a composer. He does hip-hop stuff. And he puts hip-hop beats, and he takes the most cogent several minutes of a talk. He's done this with Amy Goodman's stuff, George Galloway, Mumia Abu-Jamal, other people. He puts it to beats, and instead of a one-hour lecture, you get a five-minute hip-hop piece with mind-blowing politics that a very different sector is going to listen to. And he makes these as CDs, and you know, I listen to it as music, but it's as politically deep as anything. So imagine we ourselves, a five-minute, most mind-blowing clip put to music, and we could do remix context to have musicians put our public affairs content to music and then package those CDs as Fun Drive premiums made by our audience that kids will listen to in a way they'll never listen to a one-hour public affairs show. Bob and then Lisa.
Professor Lessig, I really appreciate the whole Creative Commons license. I think it's made a great contribution. And I want to ask you about the relationship of that to some of the more traditional intellectual property, particularly for Pacifica producers. When Dave Adelson gave us some guide questions for today,
that was Lisa's report. We collaborated a little.
Okay, Dave and Lisa. One of the questions that I want to ask you about, Professor Lessig, was about a scenario and an example of a licensing scenario that could use some of the principles that you've described. And it says, let any producer develop additional distribution for their programming in the way that Democracy Now has without having to seek permission from Pacifica, since the permissions and terms are built into the licensing. So my question is, having spoken to a lawyer recently about this, it's my understanding that the producer, and also keep in mind that 90%+ of the producers at Pacifica are unpaid, the producers already have that right. They don't have to ask permission from Pacifica for the right to distribute it to other radio stations. And, in fact, that's a very common practice that's gone on for many years. Some of them distribute it for free. Some of them negotiate payments with other radio stations. So how does that interact here when the question really isn't that Pacifica has the right to restrict in the first place the distribution of the work, the creative work of its own producers, but yet both Pacifica and I would imagine every producer share an interest in getting the broadest possible distribution of the work, but with the option that that can come back to the financial benefit of the creator if that person wants to do it that way.
Yeah, I didn't have anything to do with drafting that range of questions, and I don't actually know exactly what the relationships are typically between producers and their station around across the full range of radio. Obviously, in my view, it's a great thing if the producer is allowed to retain rights over the creative work that he or she has produced. I think that's the idea of copyright. Many organizations, though, force. Especially in a commercial relationship, force the creator to give up their rights to the corporation. That's the work for hire idea. And that, you know, I think means that it's the corporation that gets to choose. So obviously you're telling me that Pacifica still has the traditional and I think better relationship. That's great. The key that Creative Commons is trying to enable, though, is that you make it more automatic whatever rights need to be cleared, right? So you want to make it so it's easy for people to know what they can do without worrying about clicking back and asking permission, because you want somebody in the Ukraine to be able to do something without feeling embarrassed they're going to have to send an email message in English that tries to explain what they want to do exactly, right? So that's the infrastructure we're trying to do. So you pick the places where permission is actually necessary and then ask, is there a way to make more automatic that permission? And I don't think it's possible in all cases. Absolutely. Like, you know, if it's going to be a commercial use by CBS of some particular kind, you want CBS to have to come back to you and negotiate with you, because I hope you'll force them to pay you a lot of money for the thing that you want them to use. But in a bunch of other contexts, our point is we do understand what the permissions ought to be, and we ought to just make it simpler for those to be implemented.
It's also the case that at some stations people have been told they cannot do certain things with content. I mean, that's been an open question. And a previous executive director asserted that Pacifica had exclusive distribution rights over volunteer-produced content. So we need to be clear about it, and these licenses would clarify those relationships permanently, including our own distribution rights, because notwithstanding what Brian just said about a coherent license policy, he's definitely also told us that some of the content that went in there, we still are not clear on what rights we have of distribution on that stuff. And so establishing not just one license, but a series of licenses, because we have different kinds of content. We have volunteer-produced content, we have stuff we air from outside people, and we have paid work-for-hire content, and we need to decide what we're doing on that front. Ray?
Can I just add one quick sentence on that? Because Ken Freeman made a statement.
Friedman,
I'm sorry. that I think was something to the effect of, we don't let our programmers set up archives of their shows on their own websites. And that's something that well, I don't know about other stations. At WBAI, there are no restrictions. And again, I think this would fall in. I'm not an expert on the law, but I think that would fall under the legal right of the producer of the program to determine that. And it's really not up to the station, unless the person negotiates with the station to say, we can restrict your ability to use a copy of the show for your own purposes, which could include making money.
But regardless of what the rights are, if the station program director or general manager says, if you do this, you're off the air, that's a functional veto on it. And so we as a board should decide on our what is our policy on that. I probably disagree with some people here on that, but we have to come to a clear decision, because even if we do have a coherent policy on licensing, it's certainly a case, for example, that on archiving, every station has made different decisions right now about how they're going to do this. And I had Ray, and then I'll come back to Don. And we're coming up.
Can I just address that? We do allow our programmers to build blogs or websites based around the archives or the podcasts. I mean, the point is that we provide these services for our programmers. We archive every single show. We podcast every single show that we legally feel that we have the right to podcast. So there's no need for our programmers to go out and do it on their own. The reason why I think it's a really bad idea to allow programmers to set up pages that provide links to archives is just technically it's a bad idea, because sometimes archives get corrupted, sometimes archives have errors in them, and our whole archive system is driven by a database. You don't want dual databases. You don't want two databases that are attempting to do the same thing. I think it's self-evident that that's a bad idea. And if an archive goes bad, we don't want to have to manually fix it on one page and then have the database deal with the problem on the station-wide database. So we don't want our programmers to podcast their own material, but we encourage them to set up a blog based around their podcast to provide all, you know, more data about what's in the podcast. We're all for that. We just don't want to duplicate our efforts, and we want all of our archiving and podcasting efforts to be managed by one central database, just because it's a lot better. It's a much better way to do it that way.
Right.
We have our website is 20,000 pages now,
okay.
And it's managed by a database, and it has to be managed by a database. If you had people hand coding even 1,000 of those 20,000 pages, it would be a disaster.
Ray, before you, Sarv had his hand up for a while, so I'll go Sarv, Ray, and Mary. And I would like to ask a question, so if we could hurry so that we have time. We have 15 minutes left in this section, unless we can take 10 minutes more at the end.
Well, thank you, Mr. Lessig, and thank you, Ken. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm just going to go there to the simple premise. You are familiar with WBI's mission. That's where your station, you said you knew your station grew out of that. I don't know what the mission of your radio station is, but the mission of our network is to bring ideas that are not necessarily geared towards maximizing the number of audience or the economic benefit to the network. We put on air sometimes those programs we know, and we intentionally put it on the air, that they are important and we got to put it out there. So given that kind of a mission, I don't know what your mission is. Could you distinguish the mission between Pacifica and your own mission of your station?
It's a slightly different mission. I mean, our mission is not clearly articulated towards social justice the way I understand Pacifica's mission is. Our mission is also to expose and explore culture, music, and ideas that are not readily available, and we've specified even on other alternative outlets. So we're trying to be an alternative to the alternatives. And our mission, I don't think, is anywhere near as specific as Pacifica's is. But I think there is a certain similarity. It's just a very, very different approach that we're taking. While we don't have a whole lot of overt public affairs, news, and political programming, there is a great deal of news, public affairs, and politics in our programming, but a lot of it is implicit in the music. It's implicit in the DJ's attitudes. We give people a three-hour tablet to create radio, and a lot of the politics comes across within that three-hour block. It's just not done in the same way that it's done on Pacifica.
Ray?
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for both presentations. Well, it's really a non-technical question. If from the user's point of view, maybe I'm showing my age, but I relate to that box called a radio much more than the technology that you're describing. How do you resolve the tension between what I'm assuming is still a majority of listeners, people listening to the radio, and encouraging them somehow to use that technology? Or do you just address them as two separate publics?
Well, I'm not quite sure I understand the question.
You have people who don't use digital devices to listen to audio. Do you see them as distinct audiences, or do you think of them as, is that correct?
And how do you go about bringing them around?
We don't try to actively bring people around to listening online. We do get a lot of requests from people asking for help. So we spend a lot of effort basically providing customer support. People who just bought a computer who don't know how to listen online, so we provide support to those people via email and telephone to help them. We finally passed the point where over 50% of our listeners are listening online, but most of those online listeners also occasionally listen on the radio. The number of people who we have listening exclusively on the radio is just getting smaller and smaller every year. I do see that as a separate segment of our audience. It's a little scary to me how fast it's dropping. It's dropping by about 4 to 5% a year at this point. The number of people who listen only to an FM signal is quickly...
I actually think this is an opportunity for public radio because I don't think you're going to change what 60-year-old people or 70-year-old people do, right? But I would think one of the most important demographics for public radio are kids between the age of 15 and 25 because they're not listening to public radio as much as you want them to, right? Well, imagine you start enabling them to use the materials to do these digital, you know, media, civic media projects. In fact, you start working with schools and you say to schools, look, here's the archives, here are the projects your kids can do. If this becomes good, we'll play these things on the radio station. What we know from watching kids using digital technology is you don't need to do anything more than give them the opportunity, and then it becomes the coolest thing in the world for them to do. There have been amazing studies by the Annenberg Center in L.A. schools, in the worst of L.A. schools. You know, the kids who can, you know, very poor English skills, who have very difficult times, you know, doing the ordinary things that we think of schools is designed to do, teaching them to read and write. But they create these media programs where these kids who, you know, otherwise you can't keep them in school during the ordinary time, spend 18 hours a day, you know, there all the time trying to perfect their music video about drugs or music video about guns in their neighborhood or music video about what it is to be 15 and from a country like El Salvador, right? This becomes the way that they want to speak. And you just invite them and give them the opportunity to do it, they'll show you the passion. And if you can begin to translate that passion into support for public radio, you know, instead of support for Warner Music, that would be really progressive, right? So this, I agree, some people aren't going to change, but the people who are most likely to use this type of expression are exactly the people I would think you want to include.
And I just want to say, people ask the same question about email. And many people came to use it when it became necessary. Email, the same argument. Mary, I just said that question about use and the differences of use in different communities was asked about email. And when email became a necessary communication technology, they used it. Ditto when FM radio was only available on FM radio and nobody had transmitters. When there was something there they needed, they went. Mary, then Lisa... Patty, and I would still like to get a comment.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions for you, Ken Friedman. One question is, you say that the numbers are dropping of people who are listening over the air.
People who listen exclusively
over
the air.
Yeah, I'm wondering how do you know that? And also, Dr. Lessig, you mentioned people are not listening to radio. I know that the Arbitron studies say this, but I also know that the Arbitron studies are skewed with relation to certain audiences, especially the kind that we might be looking for. So it's not certain to me, if they don't listen to NPR, that they're not listening to all kinds of other things like low-power radio or what. I'm wondering how you know that. And my second question is, you mentioned that you don't have downloading of your archives. I don't know how you, I'm wondering how you prevent that. Anybody can download anything they want. If they hear, if it goes in digitally anywhere, they can do it. Well, so those are my two questions. How do you stop people from downloading whatever is either streamed or archived? And then the first question about
Your second question first. I mean, it's true that you can put software on your computer that'll capture anything that's going through your sound card, but it was also true that anybody could stick a cassette in, and it's still true that you can stick a cassette in and broadcast and copy the FM signal. And I think it's about the same number of people who do each one of those things. I don't have proof of that, but it's very few people who go to the trouble of installing a software program that will specifically capture what's traveling through your sound card. We don't provide links to download programming. And without a link to provide, without a link to allow people, it's not that easy to figure it out. It's true, you can figure it out, but the number of people who will go to the trouble of figuring it out is tiny compared to the number of people who would download. And you can go further. You can go further than we have, where you would have to be a super hacker to do it. But as things stand right now, people can just get a piece of software such as Total Recorder that'll just record anything passing through their computer sound card. But people could also take the sound card. People could also take the headphone jack of their computer and stick it into their cassette deck. So I mean, you know, there's no way ultimately to prevent people from capturing your programming. The first question: how we know that the number of exclusive FM listeners, people who only listen to an FM signal and never listen to an online signal, is dropping, is because during our fundraisers, we don't accept pledges without the donor telling us how they're listening. It's one of the pieces of information that we require of every contribution, just like a zip code. We need to know whether they're listening to our 1FM signal, our Catskills FM signal, or whether they're listening to an internet signal. We don't ask what kind of internet signal. We're not asking them, you know, which format. Are you listening to an archive or a podcast? Because there's too many possibilities. We just want to know how they're listening. And we give them the and another option is that they don't listen. And another option within our own internal database is unknown, that somehow they gave us money. Perhaps they just dropped a check off in the mail, and we just don't know how they listen. So we have five possibilities. And just based on the contributors, we're seeing that the number of online listening is going up. It's going up much slower than it was from 1997 to 2003. But the number of FM listeners is dropping faster and faster every year. And anecdotally, I'm in touch with a lot of community radio stations around the country and a lot of people around the country, a lot of other general managers and development directors who I've been in touch with, have mentioned that in the last 3 years they've seen a flattening or a drop-off of the number of contributors that they're getting. And we've seen the same thing at FMU. From 1997, the first full year that we really got into streaming in a big way, to 2003, we were seeing a huge increase in the number of contributors year upon year, 10% or more every year. It stopped in 2003. And since 2003, we've seen a flattening in terms of the numbers of contributors. And what's happening within our audience is that people are leaving the FM side and they're listening online instead. And I'm grateful, given all the competition that we face now, that we're not seeing a reduction in the number of listeners. I'm grateful, given everything that's going on and all the competition we have, from cell phones and cars to iPods to sites like YouTube and on and satellite radio and on and on and on. I'm just grateful that we're not seeing a drop off. But as much effort as we're putting in, you know, we're just seeing it keeping steady. A lot of other GMs and development people around the country are telling me that just in the last couple of years, they're seeing exactly what the bigger studies are showing, which is a drop-off in the number of listeners to public and community radio.
Okay, we got Lisa, we have Patty. Sandy has just asked to say something. We are right now 4 minutes away from the time we were scheduled to stop. We started at 10 minutes after we were scheduled to start, and I don't know if our trainers are amenable or the board is, but if they are amenable, is the board interested in taking back, say, 15 minutes from our break time during the day? We had an hour and a half of break time scheduled between the start of the training and the end of the training, in addition to an hour of dinner. Do we want to take back 15 minutes of that time to continue this discussion now? Okay, so then go ahead, Lisa. Then I have Patty, Sandy, and I'll just keep holding my tongue, if you can believe that.
I just have, I guess, a couple of comments. And one of the things that I see this as doing is kind of redefining what we mean when we say listening to radio and how we listen. Because before, when I first heard about listening to radio, I'm like, oh, please, give me a break. I'm online, you know, I'm online. But when you begin to see how the technologies can be integrated and you redefine listening, like, in my opinion, if somebody is not maybe listening to the box, but you can show that, well, gosh, they're online and they're utilizing, they're coming to the, you know, utilizing the stuff that the radio is offering online, to me, that's still a listener. So I guess it's depending on how you define that. And I've always said, or become to really see, not just with the youth, but you have a lot of people who, because they work, because they're outside a lot, they can't listen to the physical box. But when you come with creative ways, showing, because they're at work, and I'm one of those people, and you know, go all the time and visit certain kind of things. But to really, as people are talking about, really work toward integrating these technologies and getting people to understand. Because I got to tell you, when you talk about the archives and when people get emails about a certain person appearing on the show, you get that email online that you can go to the archives and can hear them. I remember one time, just a great surprise, but it worked so well, is when Minister Farrakhan was on, was interviewed, I think, on the Count on WBAI. And I happened to be online, their online newspaper, the final call, and right at the top of the paper, link, Minister Farrakhan, WBAI, you can go and hear it here. So that, to me, just helped to open my eyes even more. And I think that's what we have to redefine somewhat and challenge what we mean when we say people listening to the radio, and, you know, how we do that somewhat.
Patty?
I just wanted to...
Hang on, Mike. Is Patty's mic up?
Yeah, it's up here. Can you see? I just wanted to alert people, because I remember, Ken, during, and maybe people don't know, but during the time of when the foundation was in its takeover crisis, and WBAI took off Democracy Now!, WFMU ran it for at 6 o'clock for that whole many months. And I just wanted to acknowledge you for doing that.
Andy. Rory's concerned about the dollars. I was wondering if you can give a thumbnail sketch of running a digital station as opposed to an FM broadcast station in terms of operational cost, and maybe comment on the startup cost for those of us without any facility.
Well, I mean, we started off practically for free. It was during the dot-com mania days. And, you know, we had companies that streamed us for free. And then just gradually over time, we've started streaming our own stuff. At this point, we're spending a great deal of money on online transmission, probably about $300,000 a year for everything from hardware to personnel to bandwidth. But you can start off extremely cheaply. One of the downsides to starting off cheaply is that one of the ways you can control your costs is to put a limit through a company like Live365. You can put a limit on how many people can log on to your stream at a given time. I just think that you have to be careful about that, because you don't want to be bumping into that limit, because if you bump into that limit, it means that people are trying to listen to your station online and they can't get on. And I can't imagine that too many listeners would try too many times to get onto your station, find themselves locked out, and keep going back. So if you are going to put a limit of 20 simultaneous listeners, 50 simultaneous listeners, you have to really look at that and make sure that the first time you bump into that wall, that you raise the limit.
Quick follow-up. What is your limit?
We don't have a limit.
Thank you.
Can I just... We don't have a limit just because we're streaming ourselves, and I'm buying bandwidth in bulk.
So I wanted to add, there's also important philanthropic resources available for making this type of program available for free. So Brewster Kahle's Internet Archive has committed to giving anybody who licenses content under Creative Commons free bandwidth, free storage forever. So It's not as high quality sometimes as the stuff that you would provide on your own, but to the extent you want a backup resource for making archives available, for example, that would be a perfectly free way to do it.
And to follow up on that, that site that Dr. Lessig just mentioned is the site where Amy Goodman moves listeners from the FM radio onto her podcast, and they provide the bandwidth and server space, as far as I know, gratis. And you'll note that when you go to the Democracy Now! Homepage, it says, listen, watch today's show, and you can download it, and Brewster Kahle pays the cost of that, or you can buy the CD at the same time. And people, as I understand it, do continue to buy the CDs even though it's available for download. And this dovetails nicely with what I was going to ask, because my personal feeling is that what Ken talked about what was the name? Perform? That's coming?
Perform Act.
Yeah, Perform Act. I think the history, if you look at what happened in radio, is that you expand an audience in an era of freedom, and then you have regulatory constrictions to commodify and capture the audiences that come there. And I think we're heading into that period. People may remember that Blue Ribbon campaign that everybody fought certain kinds of restrictions. I'm worried about the day when there'll be, you know, levies on bits and things like that. And I think, you know, Pacifica could position itself as a real, I think FMU has been a leader, but I think we can also develop some leadership in this area of saying, you know, we're going to do this in an open way. And the analogy I wanted to make was with open source software, which is, if you look at the production and distribution model of corporate software, Microsoft wiped out every corporate competitor. Every competitor that was using the same production and distribution model in the era of operating systems was wiped out. And a system that had very little in the way of assets, open source software, through a commonwealth system was able to effectively compete. And the growth in that commonwealth over time was exponential, so that now it's a serious competitor, whereas 10 or 15 years ago it wasn't. And I think what we decide to do in this area is going to be a really important thing, because I don't think any one institution can defend or fight the corporate media. I think we need a different production and distribution model so that civic media can defend it. And I think that if we show that we are willing to support the expansion of civic media, we'll get support from our communities. But we need revenue to build the infrastructure for a lot of this stuff. And so what I wanted to ask was, I don't think our existing listener sponsor model can generate the revenue to do the front end work that we need to do. And so one of the things I wanted to ask Dr. Lessig was, if we were to really take what we might think of as a visionary approach to supporting the growth of civic media, do you think that there are people, particularly people familiar with the open software approach, who might be willing to help fund the infrastructural development we would need to do this properly, as opposed to on a piecemeal basis, to really found a radical new civic media?
So let me respond first to the first part of what you said, and then answer the second question. There's a very famous but important story about rates that internet radio have to pay to broadcast music across internet radio. As you know, to broadcast music across terrestrial radio, you don't have to pay the performers. You just have to pay for the underlying copyrights. But with digital broadcast, they created a requirement that internet radio has to pay the performance. So you first might think it's kind of bizarre that the established industry doesn't have to pay for something that the new industry has to pay for. But in the context of setting those rates, I was told the story, which I published in my book Free Culture, of how they were establishing what the rates would have to be that internet radio would pay. So the RIAA's expert was testifying about what they thought the rates should have to be. And one of the Real Audio lawyers responded after he testified and said, you know, that's an extraordinarily high rate. If you set that rate, we're not going to have 10,000 internet radio stations. We're just going to have about 10 or 15. And the guy explicitly said, yeah, that's what we think it ought to be. We don't think this market ought to have so many competitors. We think, you know, more manageable if we could just have 15 or 20 competitors, right? So it's explicitly deciding what the rate should be for the purpose of eliminating the diversity in speech that this medium otherwise begs for. And I think that's exactly the point you're making. I do think, you know, so Creative Commons is in the business of raising funds in these markets, and so I can say I do think that there are important foundations that would be very interested in a program that was pushing the idea of civic media. And that program would be about modeling what it would be, how you're going to contribute to it, and also what infrastructure you need to get it going. MacArthur has been a big supporter of this. And Hewlett, too, would be a big supporter of this.
You say big. What kind of numbers might be available for a project to really take a serious new tack in the area of making civic media really active and open in sort of analogous to what the open software movement has done?
Well, I have to beg off of answering that because I can't really speak for them about this. But they have contributed many multiples, millions of dollars to support the open content movement in general.
You repeat that one more time.
So if you aggregate the amount of money that the key foundations have contributed to support what we can think of as the open content movement, it's been many millions of dollars. I'm not sure to the extent to which you could convince them to give a certain chunk to this particular corner of the open content movement. But I think Pacifica, of all the organizations that could take a lead in this, would be the most natural organization to try to enable that and get the support for that.
Okay. I'll just, as long as we have one more minute, Odie, do you want to show the VPD thing? Let's do it. Just one quick thing. I mean, one of the things we talked to Dr. Lessig about when I met with him and Rob in December was the idea of creating a PodSafe archive, which is we could offer musicians to come in and record in our studios, license their content so that we have distribution rights. And the problem that podcasters have in terms of generating audience is they can't use copyrighted music. So if we created, Ken talked about a PodSafe archive, a large store of music content that they could use, then it would build traffic to our sites, and I think a lot of artists would be very interested in having their content available through Pacifica sites for that purpose. And it's something that could be done easily and right away. The other point I really think we need to get to is this question of how different stations within the network have made decisions about what they're going to make available. But so Odie's going to talk now quickly, like a few minutes, about a program called Virtual Program Director that he's been working on. And I think that should do it. Is it up? No, there's no mics. There's no audio involved. No,
You had it a second ago. It was on. There we go.
It is on there, I think.
Press the one.
Upper left yes. Corner.
this is the right one that has the web pages on it as well? Okay. All right. About 3 years ago, I think it was, Dave first came up with the idea that it might be nice for listeners and people who contribute to the station to be able to basically create their own version of a radio station on the net. And we have, 840 hours a week of content available through the five Pacifica stations. And of that, there's probably some notable stuff that that people would find interesting. So what we did about a month ago was decide to go ahead with it, and I spent some late nights creating this beginning this first cut of a system which would allow users, listener members, to basically create their own radio station, their own programming. So you can see what this says. Basically, stuff that we have available already that we allow them to use, they could put together to create their own mix of programming, which would then be available to listeners. Push the button. I don't do PowerPoint. There we go. Okay, I think that this covers, this particular slide covers what Ken has been saying and what Professor Lessig has been saying. People are listening on the net. That's one thing. And the other thing is people want to participate in this process. People have their own ideas. What you were saying about the kids, I mean, they're going to do it one way or another, and this is a tool that they can use to do that. So rather than read this, let's go to the next slide.
Well, for the online audience, why don't you...
Oh, yeah. Okay, for the online audience, I guess I should say this. Listening to digital audio is rising rapidly. We have two listeners online. Huge marketing campaigns promote listening through a variety of non-radio devices. I like that, non-radio devices. That would be your iPod. Listeners like listening on demand. iPods are all over the place. I could say stuff that I know about from the archive at KPFT. And you think about, I know my own personal preference in listening is I don't really want to listen to a download and construct my own listening. I want to hear what they're giving me. That, so if I feel that way, I know at least six or seven other people feel that way. And they don't want to hunt through this. They want to listen to a station, not a show. They want to be basically fed. That's how we use radio. They have diverse preferences. Do we know that? Have we discovered in Pacifica that people have diverse preferences? If you make a program change, what happens? Yes. Okay. So basically, we could get these individual virtual program directors to create their own stations. And one of the interesting things, where is it? I don't know what's forward. Oh, down. Okay, cool. One of the things that this can do, obviously, is create potentially another revenue stream. If you become a member of KPFT, thank you, Dwayne, I'm from Houston, you can create your own online programming. And this very potentially could appeal to some people. How would we find out? Well, we do it and see. It excites the interest and effort of listener sponsors who would like to share what they love most. Do we get calls at KPFT from people saying, that's my favorite show? Yeah. And I guess everybody goes through that. Encourage, and we obviously, if somebody creates their own mix, they're going to tell their friends. How would we do if we had everybody make a phone call to three friends saying, hey, you ought to listen to Pacifica? And the secret plan is that then we can find out all kinds of information about actual listening. Programming is about the mix. That's what we deal with when we program the station. So what we get out of this new toy, we can look at the effect of a given mix on listenership. That would be extremely valuable data for programming. More programming space. Right. New programmers can announce their shows to the family and get the VPDs involved and say, hey, well, come on, put this on your stream because you got a really popular one. And obviously, if people enter the Pacifica world through these virtual program director streams, then they become, you know, we get the 10%. We get more potential donors. Okay. So when it gets down to the nuts and bolts, the listener sponsor says, I want to be a VPD. We control who becomes a VPD. We allow them to do it. They have a pool of content that they can pick from to put on the air in their mix. They get a home page, which also has a link on the master page. I'll show you in just a second. And then people can go and listen to these virtual stations, see what's there, see what they like, and we start getting the data. This page here is kind of a sample of the kind of information of what the master page would look like. This could be on a station page, a link on a station page, or on the Pacifica page. And what we see is a list. Now, folks, this is programming stuff. So I put some silly things here. Please indulge me. It might not look like that. You can see there are two streams just that I set up. So you have the name of the stream, and you have what they're currently playing. Those links would go to a page like this one. Individual virtual program directors would have a page showing, you know, they could have a picture, their picture, picture of something relevant to them. There's the genre. In this case, it's talkative. There's a description. It could be as long as they want. You have a list of all of the things that they've included in their virtual station. You see which one is now playing, and you can see you can listen as a playlist. You can listen to the stream, which is continuing to play as though you were tuning into a radio station. And you also have the podcast, the playlist. How many of you know what a playlist is? It's a way of, when you click on a link, you'll get a list of programs that will show up in your in whatever you're using to listen to. And the difference between that and the stream is that the playlist is always going to start at the beginning, but the stream is going to be continuing, so you could pick it up anywhere. If you ask me why have both, my answer is because I'm not sure how people want to use it. I would like to find out. Do people prefer a playlist? Do they prefer a stream? I personally prefer a stream. I think it's more interesting. I guess now we wrap it up and kind of give the commercial. Obviously, our policy on licensing all of the information that we've gotten here today, Ken's experience, other people's experience with listening, is going to affect what we choose to allow people to use and what the restrictions and policies for this would actually be. That's something the board's going to have to determine. One of the things that's possible with this is that we will be able to access almost from anywhere. So we could potentially have a Pacifica list that includes content from affiliates, content from Ken Friedman, whoever wants to participate in this process. The system itself will allow that. So that pool can be huge, and we have control over it. So when I talk about the pool, I'm talking about the pool of available content. Okay. That's it.
Thank you.
Question?
Can we have the lights?
Mary has a question.
Okay, go ahead. We probably don't have so much time.
We don't have time. Look, I'm going to be here all weekend.
I just want to know.
I can show you the thing online, yeah. So I don't know if this is the best time to do
this. Yeah, I just want to know, is this available now? Is this still a work in progress? Is this something that's ready to go out the door right now? Or
Dwayne and I have talked a little bit. We might work something out so that it would show up on KPFT. Right now it's on KPFTX,
okay.
Just as a sample tool. It's based on the archive right now, but it's written in such a way that we could also be able to access stuff from, for instance, the KPFA archive, which is totally different from mine. So, yeah, we just have to work out the deal and say, okay, you know, you want to be part of it, okay, I need this information, and then that gets put into the system.
And one thing I wanted to say is WBAI right now has the most expansive archiving policy, so they make 90 days back of their public affairs programming available. So if BAI wanted to test this out, they've already got a pool of content that's big enough that this could be implemented immediately. It could be advertised in fund drives as an option, and it could be something that might help their financial situation very quickly.
Yeah, I just want to say that we could do the same thing with KPFT, because right now both KPFT and WBAI are running the archive that I wrote, and it, you know, obviously I set it for that.
Okay. We have on Sunday a section, a thematic dialogue on licensing and distribution and web interfaces, where we might continue this, but I know that there are going to be a lot of other things that are going to come up during the course of the weekend, so I don't know how much time we'll actually have available for that. But I just wanted a sense of consensus about whether the board has an interest. We're not in a business meeting right now, so we're not holding any votes. But does the board have an interest in asking our executive director to continue to work with Dr. Lessig and discuss with the board some of these licensing issues and how we might discuss appropriate licensing for our content that would be suitable to our values and our economic models? Is there general consensus on that?
Yes.
Okay, well, hopefully we can think of craft a motion that would express more concretely that. Dr. Lessig, I know your time is very precious and hard to get. Is that something you're interested in continuing?
Completely, totally interested. We have a lot of resources to help develop this, and so I'd be happy to.
And you're based in the Bay Area, correct?
Right.
Our September board meeting's in Berkeley. Ken, do you have any interest in continuing and in being in discussion about these kinds of things with us?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, everybody, for being involved with this. And with that, this concludes the public portion of our retreat. We're going to be doing some training on issues of anti-racism and with a wonderful group. I understand the name is the Institute for Survival and Beyond. We're going to be in session until 5:30. We'll have a couple of breaks during that time, then a one-hour break for dinner. We'll start our public session of our business meeting at 6:30 p.m. And thanks very much, everybody.
Thank you, Jed. Thank you, David.
You know, Rob, the only rights of producers basically circled around this issue. Occasionally,
well, yeah.
In your judgment, I mean, I'm 100%. And I now am more committed to the idea that should be in the forefront. Making materials are going to benefit. Our name will be out there. We'll be a central player. That's important. But if you have a producer name, simply packages, uses the facilities of...
Yeah, they came up with it.
There's a series of programs. Packages them. Dr. Kweku.
No, I want to continue it still. I don't suppose anyone
put them together.
But I can't imagine. No, but I just, I mean, I personally
really
trying to make anything else. So we're going to.
I'm never quite sure.
Well, I'll maybe make a motion. We'll continue to explore. Maybe I'll try to make that motion. No.
That he's offering his resignation. I'm shocked.
I accept.
I don't. I don't think that this has been truly tested. I just don't think we can go through executive directors every 4 or 5 months. But anyway, this is a deep issue. It's a much deeper issue than sentences from each of us. But it sounds like he's on.
That's where I want to go.
That'll help. If I can find a body.
I mean, if we refuse to accept it, that doesn't mean that we're going to relinquish our role.
I know.
The
one you did last night. Oh yeah, maybe I did.
So compelling that he wants to get out. I mean, is it the Ken Freeland, director's rights? I support director's rights. I think that's in a good way. I'm trying to be what problems he's actually
or which is a source of advice and resources.
Hello? 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 If I could get your attention for a minute. Hi, if I could get your attention for a minute, we're trying to coordinate lunch. Hello, testing, ABC, 1, 2, 3. If I could get your attention for a minute. Okay, those of you who would like to eat here in the hotel, there are menus. You can choose whatever it is you like, and I'll turn it in to the restaurant. We do have an alternative. Some of us are going across the street to the Redstone Pizza, where you can build a salad and maybe have a sandwich or something like that for a less expensive lunch, but we'll have to go together because it has to be paid for.